Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody, this is Pascal. We have another episode of Disrupt Disruption today with a dear friend of mine, Marshall Kirkpatrick. Marshall is currently the VP Marketing at Sprinklr, a customer experience management platform for enterprises. Check these guys out. They're the real deal. Before that, he has worked in the field already as the co-founder and the CEO of Little Bird, a startup doing very similar work, particularly on influencer marketing. And Marshall has a long history in the startup community. He was a former startup journalist and was the first writer hired at TechCrunch. So way back, Marshall could see front row seat, the essentially Web 2.0 era really unfolding. And I'm just super stoked to dig into innovation and disruption with you, Marshall, today.
Thanks, Pascal. I'm so excited to be here.
So Marshall, my first question, if you have listened to this podcast, is always the same. I kind of just want to get a sense of how do you even think about innovation disruption? What's your definition? How do you approach
it? Well, Pascal, I approach it like this. I think that it is a partially observable elephant, if you will. It's, you know, the old saying about the different parts of the elephant. Dave Gray, in his book, Liminal Thinking, says that reality is unknowable in its entirety. The best that we can do is walk around the elephant and get different perspectives on it. And I think that there are so many different perspectives on disruption and innovation that the best way to engage with it is to synthesize multiple different perspectives. And so that's what I try to do. I might also apply what Sebastian Thrun calls the four questions that anyone building an artificial intelligence needs to ask as we engage with this situation. And the first is the environment that we're building, or in this case, the question we're seeking to answer, the phenomenon we're exploring of disruption and innovation, is it a partially observable or wholly observable? And I think this is so big, it's clearly partially observable. But other things are whether the environment is deterministic or stochastic, because you'll build different AI, you know, depending on that. And I think that this is a really dynamic field that there is. I heard someone recently say, instead of asking what works, we should ask what might work now. I think it is a stochastic playing field that we're in. And the last two questions are, is the environment continuous or discrete? And I really think that it's continuous. In this case, the definition of disruption and innovation, you know, as Donella Meadows says in Thinking in Systems, everything is connected to everything. But for practical purposes, we need to draw some boundaries around everything we're engaging with and say there be dragons beyond there. But it's an arbitrary and political distinction as to how we understand any phenomenon like disruption. And finally, the fourth question that Thrun says an AI needs to answer is this environment we're building for adversarial or non-adversarial? And in the case of disruption, I think that we often think of it as adversarial and competitive, and there's a lot of opportunity to change the way we look at it and approach it in a non-adversarial kind of approach to expand our understanding in that way.
There's so much to dig into here. You had the very unique position where, on one hand, you had a front row seat to see organizations disrupt, quote unquote, as a journalist, as an observer. You also built and now work for a company that is deeply disruptive in your particular industry. How do you practically think about and approach disruption? What are the steps you're taking to stay ahead of the four quadrants you just mentioned there?
Yes. Well, I'd say that it all starts with listening. And I'm really pleased that I was able to sell my startup to the market leader in social listening that is now the market leader in customer experience management. And so in preparation for this conversation, I went and I ran some reports in Sprinklr to see quantifiably just how much diversity of perspective is there on the question of disruption. What order of magnitude is there around the extent of conversation as well? And I'll tell you, Pascal, you may be interested to know that yesterday on the internet, the word disruption got mentioned 18,000 times in one single day. And one thing that's interesting about disruption as a concept is that very unusual, one unusual quality it has is that it was mentioned in the news, on news sources, news websites, TV, radio, newspapers, more yesterday than it was on Twitter. And if you've ever played with social data, you know that Twitter is almost always the biggest source of quantity in any kind of discussion. But that's not the case there. This is something that the different constituencies talk about at different frequencies and in different ways. I noticed also that consulting and analyst firms talk about disruption much more often than futurists do. If we segment those two out, it's an arbitrary distinction, perhaps on some level, an interesting Venn diagram. But I'm not sure why that is, but I think that it could be worth a quick tour of a variety of different perspectives on what different communities are saying about this.
That is super fascinating. I would love to have access to that data. You might have heard us, we like to talk about and liken disruption actually to tofu. And tofu, if you've ever eaten tofu, you know tofu is this like soy-based substrate. It tastes like absolutely nothing. I'm a vegetarian. I eat a lot of that stuff. And then you put sauce on it and it tastes like the sauce. And disruption has become this very meaningless construct, which in some way, shape or form, I'm actually not surprised to hear from you that it's mentioned more often in the press and from consultants, because I do think it's consultant speak. It makes for great headlines, right? Like you get disrupted. Versus when you talk to the practitioners, they often have a very different approach to it. Very often they don't even talk about disruption, but rather use innovation or transform as the keywords here. That is super fascinating. That being said, I'm curious to understand, you're in a very highly dynamic environment. Broadly speaking, customer relationship management, customer experiences, marketing is shifting so quickly. It feels like quicksand. You're standing in it, you found you're grinding, and you're like, okay, TikTok is the thing. And then 6 months later, TikTok isn't the thing anymore. Now it's Clubhouse. And then Clubhouse 3 months later isn't the thing anymore. How do you stay relevant? Like, what are the practical things you have found in your career to really stay at the forefront of that stuff?
Well, I do think that listening, and I'll borrow something else from you, Pascal, that has changed my life, that I will be forever grateful for. And that is your introduction to thinking in polarities. Hmm. I so appreciate that model that you shared with me a few months ago. I think that it's a delicate dance, a continual rebalancing. And there are some upsides to disruption, and there are some downsides to disruption. And I think that in order to really engage with it effectively and maintain and drive towards the positive and the upsides of disruption, it is essential that we think of the other side of the polarity. And then you can look at it in any number of different ways. You might say that there's a polarity to consider between disruption and innovation on one side, and perhaps continuity, anti-fragility, flow, collaboration, perhaps, but especially I think flow, continuity, anti-fragility on the other side. And there are upsides and downsides to both of those. And one of the things that you taught me was that when looking at a polarity, it's important to identify the dark side of an overemphasis on either side of that polarity, and to build systems to monitor for it. And disruption, it can be a really bad thing. I mean, it can tear communities apart. It can really affect organizations adversely, individual lives, ecosystems. And so I think it's important that we make foresight and empathy and listening a real consistent practice in order to monitor for when our disruptive practices start to incur the downsides of disruption, so that we can rebalance and start investing some more back on into flow and anti-fragility and those kinds of qualities.
Marshall, let me dig into this a little bit more. And I want to particularly get into the very specific insights you're having in terms of how opinions form and how the market dynamics as in voice changes. And I'm curious, if you're looking at, and your firm, and you have done a lot of listening to social signals and seeing when do they bubble up, and the proverbial trending Twitter hashtag as just one example here. What is your experience? Like, how do these disruptive trends emerge and move? Are they moving on the old adage of like gradually and then suddenly? Are you seeing other patterns? Is there something you can probably even tune into where you say, here's indicators where change is imminent?
It's so hard to know. I mean, there's no definite answer to that. There's a variety of different models. There's, of course, the classic S-curve. There's also the what people famously talk about, the TechCrunch bump in social, for example, where startups for many years have wanted to be written about on TechCrunch and have the belief that will be their big break. But then in a couple of cases have published traffic logs showing a big jump in visitors to their website, followed by a massive decline that was difficult to say made a long-term appreciable impact. So is the peak of the hype cycle followed by the trough of disillusionment going to, per Gartner, end up coming back up to the plateau of productivity? Or is it a flash in the pan? Or is it perhaps Gene Russell, who discusses something called global thrivability, points out that in nature, in many different natural systems, there's a great expenditure of energy just before or during a breakthrough into the next stage. You know, all the caloric investment in the building of a cocoon before the butterfly emerges. And I asked my wife about that last night, and she rambled off 20 or 30 different biological systems that exhibit that kind of pattern of behavior. It is probably impossible to know whether you are the early signals that you're seeing are going to manifest as an S-curve, as a flash in the pan, or as a transformative burst. And so preparing for multiple prospective futures and bringing in a variety of different perspectives on that dynamic situation, I think, is what's really most important. It's a sister thought to the way people say that diversity and inclusion has positive business impacts, not just because of the relevance of your offering out to more diverse customer bases, but also from a diversity of perspectives on problem solving. You know, Margaret Heffernan is one of my favorite thinkers and says, anyone who tells you they can predict the future is probably just trying to own it. She says it's a suspicious form of manifest destiny. And the truth of the matter is we can't know the future until we get there, but we do have incredible powers of imagination that we can deploy to prepare ourselves for whichever future we help co-create.
Marshall, one question I get very regularly from audiences is when we talk about weak signals, as Fernand Braudel actually describes them, he's a historian, he said, they're the thin wisps of tomorrow, which I really love it as a metaphor. And the question is very often, okay, I get it, I understand, I need to look out for weak signals, I need to apply rigor towards those weak signals to figure out which of those could become a strong signal, how strong is the signal probably eventually. Also, to connect this back to what you said, as in, is this a flash in the pan? Is it a systemic change, etc.? But from your experience, and you have oodles, how do you best look for those weak signals? How do you actually listen?
Well, there are so many different ways to go about that. And I think if you are fortunate enough to connect to a community of people that can look for those signals together, then that's a force multiplier. And it is really a wiser way to do it than to try to do it by yourself. If listening is a strategic advantage, I believe it is. And I believe it is also something that may not have diminishing returns. I mean, it's an investment. Then it may behoove you to do what John Hagel calls building a community of excellence, where he says performers in many different fields, from corporate innovation to surfing to political movements, often see the most success when they are driven by small groups of 5 to 10 people who are all dedicated to the craft and to pushing each other forward together. And then the larger movement is a cellular one made up of multiple small groups with that shared commitment to excellence. So on a strategic level, I would say that. On a practical level, of course, at Sprinklr, for example, the company was just named by Forrester the strongest on the strategic axis for what's called AI-enabled customer intelligence platforms. So, you know, we work with many of the largest companies in the world, building out systems to aggregate and analyze those weak signals across all the modern and emerging channels of communication. And then I really like, almost flipping to the other side of the extreme, I like to also cast a small net. In addition to a large net, I like to use one of the tools that I use most often is a custom search engine. Google offers one. It's easy to build in DuckDuckGo as well. And it's inspired by something Walt Whitman said when he talked about writing poetry in iambic pentameter. He said there's a special kind of beauty to creating art within constraints. And so a custom search engine, the way I relate, is to draw an explicit constraint around a set of sources, you know, a persona group, perhaps, and to treat that as a dynamic reference book that you go back to continuously to take whatever you're listening for and bounce it off a specific context, a contextual group of people to see what those people say about a given matter. I find that incredibly powerful and a good complement to aggregate large-scale listening. I think that it's essential if we're going to understand disruption and innovation, and we're going to try to keep in that quadrant of positive impacts, listen for and avoid the quadrant of negative impacts, and know when we need to invest in a counterbalance to disruption. I think it's really important that we listen to as many different voices as possible. And so the big consulting firms, again, talk about disruption more than almost anyone else these days. And a few examples. Yesterday, Deloitte published a big piece of research on disruption of the employer-employee relationship. Mm-hmm. And they talked about using disruption to thrive. They said that moving into a thrive mindset requires a recognition that disruption is continuous. It's not episodic. And a willingness to use disruption as a catalyst to drive the organization forward. I thought that was inspiring. And McKinsey said yesterday that COVID, for example, caused the disruption of consumer loyalty such that loyalty now has to be earned time and time again. What a disruption of the relationship between brand and consumer. And then the last one I'll share with you from the consulting and analyst world is a report that Gartner put out yesterday. Frightening one. Gartner said that it predicts that IT and operational system disruptions from cybercrime will, by the year 2025, escalate to a point where those disruptions will harm or kill human beings. Seems realistic and frightening and like something to really valuable perspective from the world's leading IT analyst firm.
Yeah, you know what's sticks out to me as you were just going through those three examples, and this goes back to our tofu point, very varied use of the word disruption to describe very different things, not just from the outcome perspective, as in positive, negative, but arguably some of those things might be truly disruptive, as in the word definition of disruption. Some of them feel more evolutionary. Cybercrime, for example, it is evolutionary. I think what it does to us might be disruptive. So it's fascinating. It's really interesting to think about how the word there's so much to unpack in the word already, and I think that's one of the challenges we have.
Yeah.
Marshall, I'm curious, when you start spotting those signals, do you use a heuristic to kind of figure out what you're seeing there has potential to be real, it has potential to become from a weak signal to become a strong signal?
That's a really good question, Pascal, and I would say that I do that through a combination of leveraging the past and the future. Mm-hmm. And by leveraging the past, I mean implicit knowledge that I have built through engagement with my domain of interest allows me to read signals quickly and put them in a high context so that, for example, when I was working as a journalist, I set up listening systems with thousands of RSS feeds that would distribute tens of thousands of items into my RSS reader each day. And I could scan past them very, very quickly to say, nope, 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 nope. Oh, hold on. Mm-hmm. That one right there, using my gut and my contextual and my knowledge of the field to say, oh, those keywords are interesting. I know I've been seeing that several times before. I've never seen that before. That's a surprising combination of source and keyword. Let's slow down and investigate that a little bit. But then I also try to leverage the future and make some of those judgment calls with a time delay and try to recall as much as possible and record it so that the connections get made later. And I will say that Yvette, the co-founder of the Futures School, says that once something is a trend, it's not the future anymore. It's the present. And so I took that seriously when I heard it. And it's a delicate balance. I think that it's probabilistic around determining which of these might be meaningful and which might not. So I try to weigh the likelihood and the impact as I investigate them. And a portfolio of interests really helps as well. Now, I've got a set of topics that I scan for. And when I see things that have combinatorial potential, including in other fields, and there's an opportunity to say, oh, that's an interesting insight from the world of architecture or cooking, I can imagine there's an analogy here potentially that could be powerful. What if we applied that kind of dynamic into the field of artificial intelligence or digital transformation? Could there be some there? And it does require a comfort with high noise to signal ratio. I think that it is a function best performed by someone with the kind of mindset that Simon Wardley calls the pioneering mindset in his model of innovation. Some of your listeners may be familiar with his pioneer settler city planner model, where the pioneer goes out and finds a lot of new things, most of which fail, but they're the ones that find the new things. And the settlers then find the most viable of looking options that the pioneers discover and start iterating on them, but they can't bring them to scale. And it's the city planners then that go and look at the most viable settlements that the settlers have built, and they know how to really scale it, but they have a very low tolerance for risk and tend not to optimize for novelty at all. And it's really about all three of those parties collaborating well and having good handoffs between them and understanding how one another functions that helps an organization work as a consortium in support of innovation.
In the context of an organization, of a company, of a corporation, how much of this do you think is needed and needs to be done by everyone and or including the leadership team? Or how much of that do you think can be confined to your, whatever you call it, market insight team?
My personal opinion is that each of these different functions, the pioneer, the settler, and the city planner function, are so deep and rich and changing and operating in a changing circumstance that it is unrealistic to ask anyone to do all three. Mm-hmm. And I think that the best we can ask for is some understanding of different functions and some appreciation of the work mm-hmm. of the other functions. And I wouldn't ask someone who's great at building at scale to also be great at finding signals first.
Right.
I would ask that they'd be good at the handoff and that both side appreciate what one another does. But I think it's just that a specialist is going to beat a generalist across those diverse functions. That's just my gut and a little bit of experience. Other folks will say in many things that a team of well-organized generalists will beat specialists in many things, including seeing the future.
Let me go to the dark side for just a moment. And I'm curious, from your experience, what are the things, when you see companies, organizations, leaders get it wrong, what are the things you find they stumble on?
Oh, I think that failure to start is the biggest problem. I think that failure to respect and invest in all three of those functions in the Simon Wardley model is an issue. I mean, I think that it's so easy. Confirmation bias is so powerful, and it is so easy to, and has been traditionally rewarded, but to have the right answers. Jason Fox, in his book, How to Lead a Quest, does an amazing job articulating the opportunity for leaders to shift beyond the era of always being expected to have the right answers to instead being really good at asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that given the increased complexity, I mean, one of the things that the world of futurism offers that is so powerful is and it comes from the military, is the acronym VUCA, the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. That is the environment that we live in. And, you know, both the X and the Y and the Z are all subject to change. And having unexamined biases, blind spots, one of my least favorite combinations in life ever since I've been a child has been a combination of arrogance and ignorance. Deadly, deadly combination. You know, I'll tell you, though, the ambiguity might be one that is the biggest risk of a blind spot and intersected with the world of signals and social in a piece of research that the Arizona State Threat Casting Lab put out recently. They're a U.S. military funded affiliated organization. An incredible man named Brad David Johnson, who was the staff futurist at Intel for many years, is a leader there. And they were saying that in one of their newest reports about disruption in international relations, that especially when it comes to cyberspace influence operation, it is a whole new game because it's hard to know whether it's happening, how it's happening, how much it's happening. You know, are those troll bots effective? Do people take them seriously? You know, where are they all? And one of the experts that they interviewed said something I thought was just fascinating. He said that weaponized tools of mass disruption may in the next decade eclipse the risks of weapons of mass destruction. Mass disruption may be more dangerous than mass destruction because weapons of mass destruction have a finite range of acute impacts, a finite range of probable targets, and a finite range of triggering options. Whereas with weaponized disruption of discourse, that is not the case. There are far more potential types of acute impact, target, and triggering options. So it's a different dimension than traditional conflict. And I think that is, I mean, so much of life in the world is a fractal. That is not just an experience that the military is going through. At the beginning of last year, said the number one trend in employee experience, which is an essential component to business operations in the future and meeting customer expectations and customer experience and employee engagement. They said the number one factor that brands need to account for is recognition of gender diversity and not just the inclusion of women, but post-binary, post-male, man and women binary gender understanding and respect for those identities among your employees. And I said, oh my goodness, it's gotten that far? That Forrester says companies need, and that I thought was just, that was a whole new dimension that traditional corporate strategists were probably not thinking about. And then a pandemic hit. This arguably gray swan, right? Is that the right word? Some people said it's inevitably going to happen, but we don't know when. That hit and disrupted everything again. It was just disruption on top of disruption last year, some of which were on the plane that we expected. Supply chain and consumer demand and e-commerce are probably, they're a little more predictable perhaps than gender diversity and shadow weaponized mass disruption. It's a fascinating time to be doing this work. And I just really hope that we can take into account both the upsides and the downsides. And I'll tell you, if you don't mind, there's so much downside to be thinking about. But when I think about the upside of disruption, I think about what my friend Mark Schaefer discusses in terms of having a dynamic strategy. He says that in this world of increasing complexity, it can be good to take a page from the world of American football. When a football player has the ball, it is their job to watch the line of scrimmage and watch for the seams in their opponent's defense and then run through those seams and run as far as they can until they get tackled and then get up and get ready for the next play. And these moments of disruption, I think, especially if we can take into account the downsides, but optimize for the good sides, they're a continuous cycle. And let's look for the seams in them and run through them.
Marshall, that is the perfect way to end this absolutely fascinating conversation we just had. I love the image of the football player. I'm pretty sure you can translate this into any other sport if you're not into American football. It works in soccer as well. This is incredible. I loved our conversation. I love that we could dig really deep into the idea about listening, the spotting of weak signals, the identification of those to figure out what becomes a strong signal, also understanding that the future is unwritten indeed. Thus, we like to point out that there is no future. There are futures, plural. And I think it's really important to understand that there's not a singular future out there. Marshall, this was phenomenal. Thank you so, so, so much for taking the time and walking us through your line of thought and bring some really interesting statistics to the table as well. So thank you again.
Thanks, Pascal. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, Check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p, just the letter p, at finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.